The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
There is a rare occasion when the Economic Club speaker is already so well known to the audience that they really don't need an introduction. And today's guest, Mark Miles, is one of those examples, but he's going to get an introduction anyway. Mark Miles is widely known to most of you because for three decades he's been the central figure in putting Indianapolis on the map as a leader in both amateur and professional sports. That starts at the Pan Am Games in 1987 and comes down to hosting the Super Bowl in 2012. It extends now to his present job as Chief Executive Officer of Holman & Company, which counts the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the IndyCar Racing Series among its holdings. Some here today may not remember that for 15 years, Mark was away from Indy, serving as the CEO for the Association of Tennis Professionals. Mark brings to his new task at Holman excellent business credentials, beginning with experience as governmental affairs at Eli Lilly and Company, and more recently as president of Central Indiana Corporate Partnership and BioCrossroads. His immediate challenge at Holman includes expanding worldwide interest in open car racing while making physical improvements at the Speedway to assure that it remains the world capital of automobile racing. So before we hear from Mark, let's have a little film to get us in the mood. So I want us to roll this exciting revving feature.
Roll tape.
Why would these rivals risk everything? Each is driven to be the one. IndyCar. The one to win the heart of racing. IndyCar welcomes Verizon to the heart of racing and is proud to announce the Verizon IndyCar Series.
Hi, everybody. We didn't spend a lot of extra money on that. Obviously, we used it earlier in the year when we announced Verizon, but it was just supposed to get the blood going a little bit. Sherry, thank you for that introduction. People do stumble over trying to recount what I've been doing over this lifetime, and for good reason. It's sort of a checkered past. That's a pun for those of you who... Who knows how to explain it? Anyway, I am really glad to be here. I do feel like the vast majority of people in this room are friends, or we've worked together on some civic opportunity, or there might be like 0.2% degree of separation in the room. It's great to be with so many people that I have so much affection for. Reverend Hodder, it's a pleasure to have you here. I need all the moral support from Speedway that I can get. What do I say about the president of Wabash College being here, Dr. Hess? You know, I'm no longer banned. I guess time sort of, you know, salves all wounds, and whatever it was I did at Wabash is being forgiven, and I appreciate that. I've always had enormous respect for the school. What I also want to do before I get to this sort of personal story is acknowledge my wife, Helen, who is here. Helen, thank you for being here. Last thing before we get rolling is that video. Congratulations to the Economic Club. It's a remarkable 40 years, and it has played such an important role in this community. And Ted Boehm. Ted, I'm pretty sure, is with Peggy somewhere warmer at the moment, so I can embarrass him in absentia. I can't even imagine how many videos either he would appear in or people might say that Ted Boehm founded it. So whether that's the Economics Club or Penrod or the Sports Corporation, you name it, just this incredible vision and ability to see what needed to be done and do it in a way that was sustainable. So all those organizations have been here for a very long time and have had, I think, a profound effect on our community. What I thought I would do today is sort of start from a personal perspective. I look forward to the opportunity to be completely candid because I know there's no social media here. And then I found out there's it's on radio or something, so much for that idea. John Lopes is here from Andretti Motorsports, and he's going to go straight back to the paddock and, you know, correct any fibs. So I'll have to sort of be straight down the middle and maybe 90% frank. It's interesting that I find myself at the Holman & Company in the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, along with the other businesses that the Holman family owns, from my perspective, because for me, I think back to 1971 when I graduated here from North Central High School. And some of you are that old, and I suspect if you lived here then, all of us thought, Naptown, Indiano place, let's go to college and let's go somewhere else, abort, because there really wasn't much going on. And I think back about getting to Holman & Company and how I felt about the Indianapolis 500 in 1971, and it's sort of like my life having come full circle. Let's think about what the city was like in 1971. Ted should be up here telling this story, and many of you were actors in this play. Remarkable story, really. So I went back and did some checking. Think about Indianapolis in 1971 when I'm pretty sure there were a grand total of 475 hotel rooms in downtown Indianapolis. 400, and I'd like to say, if my parents had caught me in several of them, I would have gotten my tail kicked. They were not the JW Marriott. Today, I think it's closer to 7,000. The convention center wasn't near there, at least not as anything like what we know it today. Obviously, the Circle Center Mall wasn't there. Corporate headquarters like One America, Chase, Anthem, WellPoint, Farm Bureau, Emmis, Simon, etc., weren't there or weren't recognizable in today's form. Cultural amenities like the IRT, the Circle Theater, the Zoo, the Eideljord Museum, the Cultural Trail, Central Library, no, none of that was anywhere near really on the horizon. The White River State Park was an idea. It was going to be Tivoli Gardens initially, I think. And what was there? What's in that area that's sort of the next ring out from right downtown back then was a really depressed area with hospitals, hospital systems. And in fact, if you think about it for another minute, if you were around, my kids don't believe this, IUPUI not only didn't look like that, it just didn't exist. You know, there was an extension, two of them, nowhere near there, and the idea of what's there now in White River State Park and that whole area is truly remarkable. The sports strategy didn't really exist. How many remember the telethon to save the Pacers, who were playing at the Coliseum at the state fairgrounds? There's a sports strategy. Let's save the Pacers and not let them leave town, right? It wasn't exactly as proactive a visionary strategy in the early days, if truth be told, as it sort of gets credit for today. It was really a bunch of people just seeing a problem or an opportunity and digging in to do something about it. So the Pacers stayed. There were no sports venues that I can think of downtown. Market Square Arena got built. Mayor Hudnut built the Hoosier Dome on spec and sold it as a convention center expansion. That was clever. The other sports venues downtown got built. And then we started figuring out that there really was an industry we could lead in the form of hosting major sports, national championships, Olympic trials, international championships, college sports, and all the rest of it. So for me, it started with none of that in a city, you know, I just sort of wanted to leave. And I had really mixed feelings about the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Wasn't all bad, to be sure. All of us will remember being out there, you know, for the first lap, the cars lined up on 16th Street. For some of us, maybe skipping school, a little beer around, even if we were slightly under 21. I'm not talking about me, but I know people who did things like that. You know, it was just an unbelievable event and part of our culture. But I didn't like the idea that the only thing in the world that anybody knew Indianapolis for, other than maybe Eli Lilly, was this race. It wasn't exactly the civic image that I sort of at this silly age had in mind. Are we really going to be, are we only a one-trick pony? So I had these misgivings about it as a centerpiece of our culture in 1971. But I can tell you that my perspective has changed completely, absolutely, over all these years. And I think in large part because the city's grown up around us. And it's become such a remarkable place, I think, an absolute, almost one-of-a-kind success story in urban America. So, Holman & Company. I was asked first to join the board in 2012. And then after the Super Bowl, Sandy and Bill Knapp and Allison and Tom Langton and Helen and I were in the Dominican Republic about knee-deep in a bucket of pina coladas when my cell phone rings and it's the directors, the other directors, and they say, we think you ought to think about coming in and working for the company. And so we said, there's a really bad connection, but why don't you let us sober up a notch and talk about this tomorrow? And it didn't go away, and we thought about it, and there was a lot of conversation for a while, and I end up at the Holman & Company. And I couldn't be more pleased after these 2 years, which have gone through it. I think it's the speed of these 2 years is certainly a personal track record. What have we been up to for 2 years? What can you look for from us, not just there, but in our racing businesses more broadly, IndyCar in particular? The first thing that I don't always think about, but I'm learning to, is the people, the organization that's there. Lots of folks think that we would have experienced an organization that is individually very resistant to change, where the people are going to say to you, no, we don't do it that way, we do it the way we do it, you know, sort of block you out if you have a different idea. I haven't found that at all, maybe this much, but almost not at all. I think people there are so eager, so enthusiastic about improving the place. They have an enormous pride in being associated with the place, both really IMS and IndyCar, that they've been thirsty for change. What they've wanted is clarity on strategy, clarity on their roles, recognition, and the opportunity to be innovative. And I think for those of you who have run bigger enterprises, you know those are key. I've always been involved in smaller events and startups where that's been less the issue. You sort of start it the way you want it, and you didn't have to think about how to change the culture. That's been a very important part of what we're doing. And I would just, I don't know that they're here, but maybe they'll know that I said, for Cindy Lucchese to have joined us recently as our chief administrative officer and for Allison Melanchthon to come aboard, it's just such an important thing for us. They are terrifically talented. They're completely integrated in this community and will be real change agents in our culture there. So let's talk about what you see. IndyCar first, perhaps. IndyCar has been tough. If you are a historian, if you follow the sport has had its issues, its ups and downs. Frankly, I was chasing tennis balls and tennis players and not paying that much attention to it. And so perhaps, to some extent, that's an advantage because, as John and others would tell you, I really didn't want to sit around and hear about how it was and understand all of that. We wanted to talk about what the opportunity is, and I think maybe just because people knew I wasn't involved back then, it was easy enough to get people to face forward. And I couldn't be more pleased with the way that the paddock, the team owners, the sponsors, really the guts of the organization, the participants, have also been eager for clear direction and remarkably supportive from my point of view. We did try to enunciate a clear strategy. And I won't tell you more than you want to know about IndyCar racing, but I want you to know more all the time and to want to know more. We've got various strategies, but the key to it is fan engagement. We think we have an unbelievable sport. Sometimes we think of it as product. it just has so much to offer. The racing's fantastic. It's diverse. People in Indianapolis used to think it's only on an oval, a big oval. But now you know that we race on road courses as well, because you were at and hopefully will be at the Angie's List Grand Prix of Indianapolis the beginning of May this year. We also race right down the center of cities on streets, like you may picture from Monaco. Three different kinds of racing offers a diversity that's like in the tennis world. Can the guy play on clay, grass, and hard courts? It's a tougher test, and it offers us a kind of different aesthetic in each of the formats in which we race. So we love the product. There's passing, very competitive. But we felt like there were a lot of things missing to connect to the fans. And this isn't there's no silver bullets in life. None of us have had any. It's just the things you've got to do and improve on all the time. For us, the first was the calendar. So we're going to run about 17 races this year. The year I first got involved, we started at the end of March and we ended the end of October. But there was at least one stretch, I think, when we had one race in a month and then another few weeks off. And it was a really staccato-like rhythm of the calendar. So as a fan, I'm not really sure when to tune in. How do I really engage with this sport? So we've tried to say, first of all, we're not to the point where it's every other week or every week, but it's condensed in a way that we're not going to leave you if you're a fan, if you're watching and trying to follow us for an extended period of time once we start the championship for the season. The second observation was we've got to improve the television audience. And it is not rocket science to look at what's happening in the American sports scene, and we are primarily an American sport, and look at what happens after Labor Day. The NFL has regular season games and college football starts. And for most other sports, rankings tank. For sure, ours would be 25% less every time we run a race after Labor Day. So the strategy was, well, what if we have at least as many races? I think we're going to grow the number of races on the margins. End on Labor Day, the end of the championship for the year, but slide it earlier on the calendar. Let's start earlier, maybe have more of it, have it more consistently over the calendar, and end before the television audience in this country gets so distracted. That's not been the easiest sell. We feel like probably because we ended on Labor Day in a year first, and it's only this year that we're starting earlier. But increasingly, I think that our stakeholders get it, and one of the reasons is because already the television audience increased year over year from 13 to 14 by 25%, a really important metric for us. Not all sports last year saw that kind of increase in their television following. We also thought that if we make that change, we can sort of steal from Formula One and from our earlier experiences in tennis, which is a very global sport. Maybe we could start the year with a few international races. Happy to report that our friends at Formula One have created a great value proposition for us. The amount of money that they charge and get chasing around the globe is astonishing. And so we think we can do well economically, offer a great value around the globe, and just do that at the beginning of our championship. So this past year, we signed our first international race, which will be the first weekend in March this year, coming up in Brasilia. So we will all be in Brazil. Everything gets shipped to Brazil, all of the equipment, all the freight, everything that makes a race. And then when we're done, we'll come back to the States, start running, and the season will continue in North America. We think there's room for at least a couple more international races. I'd like to start just before Daytona, just after the Super Bowl. And at that point, it'll be clear to everybody that we've got a calendar that's actually a little longer than it has been in the past, and we think we can take advantage of international markets and tap more deeply into the U.S. market. So the calendar is really important. We think, you know, clarity around what our brand proposition is really important. That spot that you saw was an example of that. What is it? I hope it gets your engine running a little bit. It's about speed. It's about daring of the drivers and skill of the drivers. Increasingly, it's going to be about technology, and I'll talk more about that in a second. I could go on. The important thing to me is that we had a really good year. 2014 was really our first year. We had 25% increase in television ratings. We had much bigger increases in all the social media in terms of engagement. We signed Verizon. What an incredible partner as the title sponsor of the series. So their advertising budget, they have over 100 million customers. Their advertising budget is $1.6 billion or so. They spend on sports about $600 million a year in advertising. They dropped the NHL, and they said at the time they wanted to focus on their two primary sports engagements, the NFL and IndyCar. I was in my office when I read the quote from their CEO, and I scratched my head. What is it that the NFL and IndyCar have in common? In a way, not a lot. But in another way, it says a lot about our future marketing direction. Verizon has been seen as a wireless company. They are determined to be seen, as they think they are, as a technology company. And so the amount of work that's being done to partner with them to think about how we can take the unbelievable content, which is IndyCar, think about all the information that comes off of cars, all the angles, think about Google Glass on lenses and the safety trucks that pull up to an accident, and in an encrypted way, this is not a public thing, can convey important information straight to medical centers. There's so many things we can do with technology, both to engage fans and provide almost a personal entertainment opportunity at a track or at home, often through the Verizon app, but also for the way we function. They are an incredible partner for us, and they're making a very strong statement about the future of our sport. So their signing was hugely important and helpful economically as well. And as I mentioned already, we signed our first international race. What about 2015? As I said, I hope to finish globetrotting a little bit in the next couple months and be able to announce one or two additional international races for the beginning of 2016. And then maybe the big news that all of you will see and hear about this year is the introduction of aero kits. A year ago, I wouldn't have known what an aero kit was. So you might not either. It's basically ways to put other parts on the chassis of the car to make it more aerodynamic. What is that going to do? Among other things, it's going to make us go faster. IndyCar is the fastest series in motorsports where you got to turn the wheel. And many of you, like me, probably remember, I think, in 1997 when Tom Carnegie last set a new track record. Been a long time. That was about 137 miles per hour. A year ago, we were about 200, more than a year ago, about 228 miles per hour. To us, we are going to do everything reasonable to be safe as we get a little faster. But we think there's an unbelievable story in the innovations required to press the pedal. And so I think you'll see when the aero kits are announced at the beginning of this season that the cars are going a little faster. If I had to bet, I would bet it won't happen in 2015. But for the 2016 running of the 500, our 100th running of the 500, I'll be disappointed if you don't hear those words again. So that's new. Let's talk about IMS. How am I doing? I'm doing okay. It would have been, I hope, obvious to you that the first thing was to focus on May, the core of our racing business, the most important thing, the most important reason you're here, to think about what's going on at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So we looked at May, and some of you have heard us talk about this. We looked at the first weekend. There's three now, opening weekend, practice. And that may be not compelling if you're not really a hardcore fan. So we didn't sell that many tickets on my first opening weekend. Then qualifying. Qualifying is not what it used to be. And whatever it is, it's much less in terms of attendance on the second day, bump day, than it is on the first day, pole day. We thought, huh. So the climax is at the beginning. The warm-up act is at the end. And we only got about 33, 34 cars trying to get in. Is bump day really bump day? Maybe we should just sort of candidly look at that and see if we can't build to a climax on Sunday by changing the narrative. And then we looked at the race. And it is really hard to figure out how to improve the race, although I think the attendance grew last year, and I think it will continue to. But that weekend looked like a big opportunity. Basically, we have with the festival, have the parade. Lots of things going on in town, but not much out there. Autographs can be signed on Saturday, the day before the race. So we said, you know, if you live in town or if you're visiting and you're going to be there in Indy by then, there's got to be an opportunity to do something else big on the day before the race. So you know the story. We brought an IndyCar road race event for the opening of the first weekend. We set a goal of a little over 40,000 seats, and we met it. It's kind of the anti-Indy. I think it starts May with a bang, gets people really focused, gives you a reason to come out there. But it's not like the 500. It's really sort of festival seating kind of event where you ought to bring your kids, and you won't pay for that. And you can sit on the mounds. It's a very different kind of racing, but it's our cars, our drivers, our teams, and you get to know us better. We changed the narrative, as I said, for qualifying weekend, and that played very well with the media, with fans, in terms of building a story and focusing on the first day on our best teams trying to get in the top 10 so they could try to get the pole on the next day. And then we had the Jason Aldean concert. And that's so we had to cut it off at 40,000 spectators for that concert. So year over year, total attendance went up by just that 74,000 and some hundred seats, almost 75,000 increase in attendance, which was exactly what we had in mind. And I hope you all got paid a little more attention, came out and understood what we're all about more. The other thing that we did is persuade ABC to cover all three weekends. The television audience nationally to look at IMS in this city increased by over 50% in the aggregate over the month of May by not going back and forth between our two broadcasters. What can you expect there for 2015 and 16? The Aero Kits will, I think, have create a real buzz. Even if you don't understand how it happens, even if you're not a hardcore fan, you will see cars going faster, I think safely, and I think that's going to be a real thrill. You'll also see us developing what we've internally called Project 100. You know that a couple years ago, we went to the legislature and we asked for help. The place is venerable, which is code for old. And it's big. And so the idea of keeping those facilities competitive at a time when new tracks are springing up, others are being proved, most of all that investment is being, at least in part, fueled by public funding in other places, we didn't mind asking for help. And the Holman George family agreed. And the reception of the legislature was remarkable to me and really impactful in the way we think about our work. I'll tell you the story really quickly of the first day we testified in front of the Senate Appropriations Committee. We made our little dog and pony show, told them what we were about, reminded them of the economic impact of the organization. And then we got to that point where Senator Kenley was going to call on the other committee members and ask for questions. And the first senator raised his hand and said, "My county sold them the bricks," and went on to give a testimonial about in the days when the track was bricked, how important it was to their county as an economic development enterprise. And the next senator said, "My dad took me to my first race 37 years ago, and I haven't missed one yet." And basically what happened was the next eight senators gave their own personal testimonial. And I'm thinking, this is cool. I can handle these questions. I want you to know the legislature subsequently and privately did their duty, and there was all kinds of due diligence, and we got hammered in the details. But it really spoke volumes about how our people's representatives get it and understand how much that place means to Hoosiers all over the state, means a lot to us. So by the end of the first quarter of this year, bonds will be sold by the state. I think the net bond proceeds are going to be about $90 million, and we're going to be able to make what I think will be important improvements in terms of the investments out there. Most of the money is going into seating, the stands. We think that the main straightaway is the iconic real estate in all of motorsports, and yet right now there are green folding chairs that have been there since I think 1970s, and suites were built either in the 80s or the 90s at the latest. The place needs a lot of upkeep, updating, and so that will be a big part of it. Technology will be the second biggest bucket. We're going to make it a much better fan experience by giving you the content that's out there but you otherwise have a hard time getting. And, of course, that's really appealing to people who aren't here, our kids. I can't remember the last time our kids sat in front of a television to watch something and didn't have another device in their hand. It's just the way it is. And we'll be leading edge, I think, in providing that kind of technology to the experience out there. with Verizon's help and the investment of these funds. There's a lot of fan engagement stuff. You will see elevators, all kinds of things. It is not completely transformational. We could use more, but I think it'll make a big dent. And all of that is going to pretty much get done after this racing season and for the 100th race, May of 2016. So just a word about that, and then I'm happy to close. Allison Melancton is there to help us think about how to improve all of our racing at IMS every day, every year. But a central part of her thinking is this opportunity, the 100th running. And it's way too early, a little too early, to talk about the specifics, but I can tell you the way we think about it is that this place has an international relevance. And so we want to take the opportunity to revive and remind people around the world what the 100th running of Indianapolis Motor Speedway is about, what the Speedway itself and that race is about. And nationally it has a relevance, and we think we need to exploit that opportunity and make sure it's not just about the day of that race. We're sort of saying metaphorically, what's our torch run? I don't think that means that literally, but how do we extend the opportunity to capture fans' attention around the country? And then locally, we're going to do it again. To me, this is a Super Bowl experience. Our ambition is that if you have a house and you have a porch, you will have checkered flags on it. If you have a building and it has a facade, we'll ask you to put something on it. We will find ways, sort of Super Bowl-esque, Sports Corp-like, to say, to invite everybody to celebrate this party and this occasion. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And one of those moments that we'll all reflect on and think about what it meant to the whole community and to ourselves. So we're looking forward to that. I'm going to close with that, except I think there's one more short video that will give you a little bit of the feeling, at least that some of us have, for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and then we're happy to take questions. Thank you.
And they're off!
Flirting with death at over 100 miles an hour on the curves.
Great race, boys! Great race!
Well, I'm awfully glad that we won the race.
He's on it.
You just don't know what Indy means.
Have you been to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway when it's dark and still? Sometimes you hear something. A whisper from the shadows, echoing softly through the cool air, trailing away down the straightaway and into the turn. In that sound is the history of the place. Every driver who ever competed, every car that ever ran, every person who ever thrilled to the challenge of man and machine against the gods of speed. This is no mere racetrack. This is a temple. This is the most hallowed ground in motorsports. This is Indy. It is the spirit of history, memory, tradition. It is in the vehicles, the boxy, early racers with their skinny tires, the roadsters, brawny cars driven by brawny men, the exciting rear-engine cars pioneered in the 1960s, today's cars, darts on wheels with jet fighter profiles, the sound, engines roaring past, announcements ringing through the PA system,
track record,
voices describing the races to a worldwide radio audience with eloquence unmatched in broadcasting.
Now stay tuned for the greatest spectacle in racing.
The drivers, whose names still bring inspiration to Gasoline Alley, whose triumphs are recorded forever in books and on trophies. At Indianapolis, triumph and heartbreak live side by side. With every thrilling start, every watch through your fingers pass, every duel to the finish, comes the chance that a life, a friend, a hero will be lost. But their souls live on in the greater spirit of this magnificent place. The spirit that brings us back year after year, through the tunnel and into the light, to stare in amazement at its sheer enormity. It sends the electric current of anticipation through the air as we find our seats. It makes us all Hoosiers as we sing together.
Come again in Indiana.
It gives us the goosebumps that ripple from the first roar of the engines through the world's fastest flying start. And then again, 500 miles later, as the checkered flag snaps to attention, ready to salute a new winner. This is the spirit of the Speedway. The spirit that touches all who enter. The spirit that swells our hearts and quickens our pulses when we hear the most thrilling call to action in all of sport.
Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines.
Reminder, please use the white cards on your table to fill out questions if you have them for Mark, or please get on the Twitter and tweet me some questions at Economic Club IN. Mark, let me go ahead. First of all, we have one audience member that's a little confused and asked, what is baking powder and is it different from baking soda? And does it have an application as fuel in IndyCar racing?
What was the last part of the question?
And does it have an application in IndyCar racing? But we'll let that one go.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad to get that question because obviously I didn't mention, maybe not obviously, there's sort of three other parts of the Holman company. I'll get to baking powder and soda. But we have a television production company on West 16th Street that does live production. We have five of those big trucks that are everything that's required to the facilities to produce live coverage. So if you watch an L.A. Laker game from the Staples Center, our trucks are parked there to produce that feed. We have post-production work to create commercials and all the videos, like the one you just saw right there on 16th Street. We've got a couple real estate companies that have various parcels of land. And then we have Clabber Girl, which is an incredible story. A company founded by the family in 1899 in Terre Haute. And today it has a market share of baking powder sold through the retail channel, groceries, which I am not at liberty to disclose because some of you may know people at the Justice Department. When I started, I could read financial statements, but I started with that very question. What's the difference between that stuff my mom put in the refrigerator in that yellow box and baking powder? Turns out baking soda was to keep the fridge fresh, and baking powder was to put in an ingredient in stuff you're going to bake or your wife is going to bake or your mom's going to bake that needs to rise. So there you go. There's a technical explanation of what it is. It's an unbelievable company. It continues to grow. To diversify its product line. We think we have some technologies that may get us into animal food products, a whole other market, and so I think its future is bright.
We have a couple of questions about will there ever be an Indy 500 race under the lights, a 24-hour sort of race or a night race?
Every wacko idea you can imagine has occurred to us, so never say never. One of the legislators who was a sponsor of the legislation that created this pool of money for investment told everybody we were going to put lights up, but I think at least for now we're not. It's just frankly, we could spend some multiple of the amount of money available to us to improve the place. Lighting is very expensive. You don't just light the track, and we just can't quite see the ROI. Frankly, it was considered much more carefully from the point of view of the NASCAR race than the 500. There's a lot of you always try to decide what's tradition and what's heritage and what's habit. And so, you know, that's a discussion you have with yourselves every day. And whether a night race at the 500 would be breaking a fundamental part of our heritage or not, I don't know. But I know right now we can't afford it, so it's not going to happen.
Any chance the IRL will go to Road America, and any chance F1 will return to Indy?
Yeah, there's a race fan question. Road America, very traditional, very well-regarded venue in Wisconsin, road course. A lot of our paddock would like to be back there, and I wouldn't say that that's out of the question. in a lot of ways, we'd like to race there, but we've got a lot of races in the Midwest in IndyCar, and we don't have a lot, for example, on the Eastern Seaboard, so, and there's a limit to how many we can put on the calendar. So I think it's difficult to figure out right now how that fits with our strategy in terms of the calendar, but it's a neat place. Someday we may figure out how to do some non-championship races after the championship ends, after Labor Day, and if the weather's okay, that would certainly be a big opportunity. What was the second part? You've already moved on.
Any chance F1 will return to
Formula One? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Could the Formula One race come back? We set a goal of going from 400,000 total paid attendance for a year at the Speedway to 600,000 by 2018. As I mentioned, we got plus 75,000 in the first year in 2014, so we're on our way. I'm not sure we can get to that goal by simply kind of organic growth. So the first thing we've done is add some smaller events, but really cool events, like sports car racing that was there this past summer. That's coming back. We missed the ball there. We thought it was mostly about the enthusiasts and the participants, but people here really wanted to come see it. It was really cool. Mm-hmm. So we sold somewhere between 10 and 20,000 seats, and that will go up because we'll market it this time around. And then there's an event called Bloomington Gold. Doesn't have anything to do with ketchup. It's the, I think, second largest Corvette gathering in the country, and it's coming here this coming summer. We think that's 25,000 people. So we're doing that. I'd still like to see if we can't get our hands on one more, you know, globally significant big event. And Formula One is, frankly, just does not present business terms that make sense to us at the moment. But if that ever changes, we certainly will have some kind of conversation.
You've talked about many different forms of auto racing available to the consumer. Is there any particular one that stands out to you as the most successful? Or are they all sort of the same from a public acceptance perspective?
Well, I wish we were all on the exact same platform. But obviously in the last several years, NASCAR has grown to a very significant level and is a bigger enterprise than IndyCar, open wheel racing. Formula One globally is the juggernaut, I would say. Interestingly, we want to see them succeed. It's our industry, and we're not looking to see major players in our industry not do well. So please don't misunderstand. But I think I like our direction from a different base, and I think we all have challenges, but both of those two, while much bigger, certainly have a little more headwind than we do at the moment.
Coming from someone new to the sport, and I don't think this is always true, but wants to know why winners drink milk.
Oh, my God. Somebody help me. I can't remember the first winner. It used to be that if you won the race, they asked you, what do you want to drink? And I don't know, Macallan was probably not readily available in those days. So whoever it was, I'm going to get shot for this when I get back to the office. Anybody know? Who was the first driver who said milk?
Louis Meyer.
Louis Meyer, yeah, I was going to say that. said make it milk, and I think it was buttermilk, which nobody else wants to drink. Since then, somewhere along the line, the Dairy Association has gotten involved, and
sure.
It's going to be milk for as long, as far forward as we can see.
That's great. And lastly, someone wants to know, would you ever consider running for public office mayor with a question mark? So sounds like you're
You know, you let this go one question too long.
I did. Let's give Mark a big thank you.
Thank you all.
Information and tickets for each of the season's presenters can be found at economicclubofindiana.com. Thank you again for joining us today, and stay warm. Take care.
Thank you.
Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation. With a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.